Wanted.
Average, unexceptional, ordinary men to take on everyday tasks under challenging conditions. Honour and recognition in case of success. Welcome to
Dad Ringer.
Yes, hello and welcome to Dad Ringer. I'm your host, Ian John, for what is essentially two men talking stuff. In each episode, I'll chat to my guests, I'll find out about them, and we'll try to cover some interesting topics. So let's get on with it. My guest for this episode is a design engineer. He's done that since he left school. He works for an engineering consultancy in the automotive sector using something called CAD, which I've never heard of before, so I'll need to ask him about that. His clients have included Cadillac, McLaren, Aston Martin, Ford and Dennis Eagle. He's been married for 28 years. He is Essex born and bred, only venturing outside Essex when he lived in the United States in Michigan for 4.5 years. He has two sons in their 20s, Finn and Harry. He's also a musician and he has a stage name. He's a strong advocate for mental health awareness and is very candid and forthright about his own issues with mental health. He is Chris Robson. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome to the Shub again.
Hello.
You've been here before.
It's such a beautiful place.
Yes, thank you for joining me, Chris. And as I say, you've been here before. You've seen the Shub. I've added a few little things. Probably you won't necessarily notice what I've added, but it does feel a little bit smaller.
It does, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely more knickknacks.
Knickknacks? They're not knickknacks.
In the best possible way, obviously. I like the clock.
Yes, very good. My fishy clock, yes. Yeah. Okay, so first thing is, Chris, we'll talk about your stage name.
Yes.
So, Chris Robson. So, Robson is the stage name, isn't it?
Yeah, Chris Robson is the stage name. My full name is Chris Robson Debenham. Chris Debenham, I didn't think had quite, not that Chris Robson has a ring, but Chris Debenham definitely doesn't.
Yeah.
It's more of a clang than a ring. So, I decided to get rid of the surname and just go with Chris Robson.
Where does Robson come from? Because is that a middle name?
Robson is my middle name, and that comes from my father's side of the family. I think my grandfather's mother's maiden name was Robson.
Oh, so
he had it as a middle name. So
it was originally a surname that's then been put into the...
That's right. Okay. And now my eldest son is unfortunately...
You've given it to him.
He's got Robson as well. Well, I gave him two middle names, so Robson's one of them. But yeah,
two middle names?
I know.
Oh, I just got John. Yeah. I didn't get anything interesting, just John.
There you go.
Okay, Chris, so we'll have a nice little chat. There's a lot to unpack in the introduction there. The first thing I need to double check, did I say Michigan right?
You did say Michigan right.
Okay,
yes. Good. Not Michigan.
It's not Michigan, no, no. We do have some listeners out in America, and I know that we've got some that are listening in Illinois, which is only the other side of the lake.
Yeah.
Now, when I say a lake, it's probably, I think I can see over the other side, but I don't think Lake Michigan is the same, is it?
No, the lakes are, they're just like the seas, you know, they have waves. The only thing they don't have is a tide.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can get some big waves on there. They have shipping lanes. They have huge ships that go through there. It's incredible.
Yeah, when you look on a map, it looks quite small. But I think when you then realise you could probably fit the UK into most states, two, three times over, couldn't you, in America?
Well, I think the UK would fit into Lake Superior, I think.
Really? Oh, crikey. Okay, so we'll have a little chat about you living in America. So I'm going to go right back to the beginning to unpack some things. So the first thing is what is CAD?
CAD is computer-aided design.
Okay, so this is you and this is your job and that's what you use, yeah?
Yeah, that's what
you'll
I
have
use.
To explain it to me because I'm a complete Luddite.
Well, when I left school, this is what my father did as well. He was an engineer, and when I left school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. He said, oh, there's an apprenticeship going at my company. I thought, well, yeah, why not? What have we got to lose? So I went and did that. And in those days, computer-aided design didn't exist.
Yeah.
It was all done on what's called drafts, which is basically a table that's about 20 foot long, and they roll out huge drawings on them. And I learned to draw, you know, with compasses, pencils, yeah, and technical drawing. But by the end of my apprenticeship, it had all started turning to computer-aided design, mm-hmm, which is basically drawing with the aid of a computer. Yeah. As simple as that, really. It took a lot of the pride and artistry out of design. If you talk to some of the older engineers who had been drawing with pens and pencils for years before CAD, they hated CAD because anyone can do it to a degree. And they used to spend hours, you know, with their handwriting and getting the lines right and accuracy. And CAD just does it all for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I do. So basically the CAD designs parts of a vehicle.
Yeah. So I love what you said about the compass set. I remember we all had one of those at school, but I'd never used it properly. I would think I used to just use it for scratching my name in the desk. But you obviously put it to good use.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, the compass, I remember when I got my professional compasses, they cost an absolute fortune. And they're all, you know, precision bits of engineering themselves.
So do you still have them?
I still have some. I've kept some as a memento.
Okay.
I sold most of them at a boot sale.
Oh, really?
For about 15 quid. Oh, wow. But no, I've kept some just so I can look back. And
so obviously, you know, I don't know how to... So freehand, I suppose, you did it without non-computer aided when you did your apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Do you go back and still sort of practice that skill? Because it's a skill that you acquired.
No, I mean, don't get me wrong. We were... I do engineering design, so it's not really freehand. It was always using set squares,
slide
curves,
rulers.
Rulers. You were always drawing along something or around something or with something. The people who draw freehand are the stylists.
Yeah.
And the stylists, when it comes to a vehicle, they will draw a picture, an artistic impression of the vehicle they want the engineers to build.
Yeah.
And we get their picture and we say, you can't do that.
I was just going to say, I can just imagine with your arms folded, tutting, going, that's not going to work.
Exactly. So that'll never work. You can't do that. You can't have this. You can't have that. And so the first part of the design process is kind of a compromise between the people who dream the dream of this fantasy car and the realists who say, well, that's not going to work.
Yeah, so the creatives come with all their curves and wobbly bits, and then you just put straight lines in everywhere.
Exactly. Basically. That's basically it. Yeah.
Excellent. And you said, when I said in the intro there, so Cadillac, McLaren, Aston Martin, Ford, these are all companies that you've done designs for?
Yeah, well, worked on a team of engineers that do it. It's there's many, many people going into the design of one vehicle. Over the years, I was quite fortunate that I did my apprenticeship with an engineering consultancy who used to get jobs from a lot of the other major players. Because most of the engineering design in the world sort of 30, 40 years ago was done by British engineers, and say 30 years ago, there was quite a few design consultancies around, and the big players would farm out, you know, the hard bits to the design consultancies, and then take it back to produce their vehicles.
So when you're actually designing and engineering, so I'm sitting here now imagining that that's you. There's a Chris Robson car out there that you designed for McLaren, or is it more specific parts that you? Because you say there's a team of you, so do you get like the door?
Yeah, I mean, I'm,
are you the doorman?
I mean, you will get a bit. You'll get I can't remember what it was for McLaren. I think it was the hood.
Yeah.
Or you might have part of a door, or you might have, it's just bits of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not a petrol head. I'm not a car guy. I'm not that kind of guy at all.
Yeah.
This is a job that I sort of fell into, and it's become weirdly, it's become a job I can't get out of now, even though I really would like to. I'd like, because I don't particularly enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the creativity has been sapped out of it over the years. But you get to a point in a career where you have to weigh up the money that it's bringing in against putting up with what you don't like. And that's...
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel possibly in the same place as you in that sense. I feel there comes to a point in anyone's career where you feel that it's moved on a little bit more and you feel that you've done your bit.
Yeah.
And the time to keep chasing and catching up with all the new stuff is kind of like, you know what, I can't be bothered. Yeah. But like you say, you have to, unfortunately, that time comes before the time that you can actually possibly go, doesn't it?
Well, it's true. And what's happening, I think, not just with people's jobs, but the world over, things are being made so simple so that anyone can do them.
Yeah.
So jobs are becoming less valued and... You know, I don't get any self-satisfaction and pride out of doing my job because it's been boiled down to a list of procedures and things that anyone can almost do.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I'd much rather be just out strumming my guitar.
Exactly. Yes, yes. Wouldn't we all? Yeah. Well, I did want to ask, because one of the ones I mentioned was Dennis Eagle. Now, in my mind... Dennis is very much a British company, but I mean, I could be completely wrong because we know them. Yeah. I mean, I know Dennis from either refuse, you know, the rubbish, the lorries that come round, or fire engines.
Yes. And Dennis Eagle isn't a British company now, but it was.
Yeah.
And I was involved in a rubbish truck, and it was one of my favourite projects I've
really?
Been on.
Excellent.
I much preferred it to like the supercars or anything like that, because it was, I call it proper engineering, you know, it was 12 mil thick steel panels and things. We were involved in doing a prototype for an electric rubbish truck, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on that for a couple of years, and we had the whole vehicle apart from the engine. It's all bodies I work on.
Yeah.
So, and we came up with it, and we were involved in the actually going to the manufacturing plant, supervising the assembly of it, seeing it all welded together, and then we saw it come off the line at the end, which we often don't see the vehicles we design. So that was really good because I felt like I could actually see what I had done.
Yeah.
Rather than just, oh, I did that bit of an ashtray and a whatever.
Or, bit of an ashtray to car, that's going back a bit. And how long ago was that with the refuse truck?
That must have been about 2012, I would say. 2012,
oh, right, okay.
2014, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're still, I mean, obviously they're still going, they're still rolling those out now, and we're going to see more and more of them, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, we should all be going electric soon.
Should be. Yeah, with the price of fuel as it is.
Yeah, I think we'll all be walking. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I'm making a leap here with the engineering and that to you being in America, and particularly the place in America, because obviously it's very, the state that you were in is Detroit. Yeah. Detroit's in that state, isn't it? So, which is obviously Motor City.
Yes.
And so is that why you were there?
Yeah, that's exactly why I was there. I mean, I did my apprenticeship, and at the end of the apprenticeship, our company had offices in Canada and Michigan, and Basildon, all the high-class places. At the end of the apprenticeship, they took the four top apprentices and said, look, we'll send you out for some experience to our American office for 4 months, all expenses paid and everything. So I did that with three other of my friends I'd made during the apprenticeship. And, I absolutely loved it. Surprisingly, because it was a big step for me. Yeah. I wasn't really, I'm still not an outgoing kind of guy.
Yeah.
But I had a very good friend who was going as well. So, yeah, we stayed out there for 4 months initially, working. Like I said, all our expenses were paid. We had a car. And, you know, we were all young, free and single, yeah, and we had a whale of a time. So then after the 4 months came back, I came back to England for, I think, about another 6 months. That's when I learned my first CAD system. And then I had the opportunity to go back out there. And at that time, I went out there for a year and a half. And, yeah, that was a really, really good experience. Good life experience and getting out there. That was the first time I'd really lived away from home.
Yeah.
So it was quite a huge step from not just sort of moving to Westcliff in a bedsit. I moved to the other side of the world.
Yeah.
But, yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it. And then came back after my first 18 months in America. I'd made quite a lot of money then because we were on a good deal out there. We used to get paid our expenses out there and get paid our wages into our bank in Britain. So the wages were piling up. And I came back and thought, oh, I'm going to take some time off. I'm going to become a musician. And I took 18 months off. Did very little music. I drank a lot of beer. I ended up living in a flat above the Grand in Leeds.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And basically ran out of money. But during that time, I also met my now wife, Carissa, who was working behind the bar at the Grand. And that's how we met, because I was in there every day. And so was she. So we met Carissa. Then I went back to work out of necessity, really, and went back out to America because the same team was still out there that I'd worked for before, and they were quite happy to have me back. So we both went out there. And then how long were we out there? We were out there for about 6 months, I think. Yeah, 6 months or so. Then we came back for a little while because I think the project had got canned or something. And then a few months later, we had another opportunity to go out there, and we both went out there for 2 years then. I had an absolute whale of a time, and part of me would have liked to have stayed out there and not come back.
Back and forth quite a lot, really.
And the reason we came back was because we decided we didn't want to bring up children in America. We'd rather bring them up over here. And in hindsight, I think that's a big mistake. Or really, it didn't matter. In hindsight, it didn't matter.
So when you it sounds like you were probably on the cusp of a very big decision about where you both were going to be and start your family. What did you, I mean, you know, both America and the UK have changed hugely in that time, but what did you see the big differences between America at that time and the UK?
What I liked about it, I found it very accessible, and I found the people very friendly and open, which I think is what a lot of people who are not, I don't want to say the minority, but, you know, if you go to a foreign country and you're working with people, they tend to take an interest. Yeah. You're a bit of a novelty. And back then, there was quite a few English people in that area because of the motor industry. But in the bars and things, it was still a bit of a novelty. Yeah. You know, they loved their accent and things like that.
Did they get it? Did they get the accent, or did they think you were Australian? Because that's what I've heard.
No, I have been called Australian. Once I was even asked if I was German.
Really?
Which I don't quite understand.
Yeah, I think the perception is that we all talk like Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, I loved it. And for me, I always struggled with shyness, as it was called then. It's probably called anxiety now.
Yeah.
And I found a lot of that didn't go away over there, but people were so forward, and most Americans are, as you'd expect, quite extrovert and quite willing to you know, yeah. be the one to get to know you, to start the conversation. How can I help you? Have a yeah. nice day. Even in the shops and things, you know, you were pounced upon as soon as you walk in a shop and with people wanting to help you.
Yeah.
And I like that. And whereas over here, I always felt like you had to make the effort.
Yeah, everyone's a bit more surly, aren't they?
Yeah.
And you, what do you want?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I've always found that very difficult. So that's the main reason I think I loved it out there.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate in doing a good job. And for someone my age, it was well paid. I wouldn't want to live in America if you didn't have money. That's a very different story.
Yeah.
But... yeah.
I wouldn't want to live anywhere without any money, really.
No, but I know living out there. I mean, the first time I was out there for a long period of time, I broke my leg.
Right. Okay.
I fell over a small fence at about 2 o'clock in the morning.
All right. Okay.
but I had to have I chipped a bit of the bone off, so right. I had to have it screwed back in.
Yeah.
And I think the bill I got for that was over £10,000. But it wasn't, fortunately, I had the insurance because yeah. you know, a company paid for insurance. But if you didn't, then, yeah. you know, this is what people have to deal with. There's no health service as such.
No.
So we are, I think we're quite fortunate.
We are very fortunate to have our wonderful NHS.
People complain about our NHS now, but
I don't think people
would be lost without it.
Unfortunately, I think the people in this country don't really truly appreciate how lucky they are to have the NHS.
Definitely.
Okay, so you talked about Clarissa and you talked about family. So you made that decision to come back to the UK. You came back to your roots in Essex, in Westcliff-on-Sea, the wonderful sunny Westcliff-on-Sea.
Yes.
From there, obviously the family's starting. So, just where are we up to in years about that time?
End of
the 90s?
Back, yeah, we came back from America in 97. And Harry was born in 98. Yeah. When we'd got married in 94. Yes, I think that's right.
Better get this
not
right.
As close.
You better
plus
get this right. I'm recording
years.
It.
Yeah. So we got married. In fact, we got married. We were planning to get married, but on one of our trips back from America to visit family, like we used to come back at Christmas and things like that, when we returned to America, Clarissa was sent home again by the immigration people because they didn't believe that I was going to support her.
Oh, right.
Because we weren't married at that point. So she went home on the next flight. I stayed out there for, I think, about another month or something. And then I went back and we decided, well, we both want to go back to America, so we better bring the wedding forward. So we brought the wedding forward, which is why we got married in February. but, yeah, then, like I said, Harry was born in... 98, and Finley came along in 2002.
Yeah.
2001.
So, as I said at the beginning, they're in their 20s now. What are they up to?
Harry's in his final year at Brunel University. He's doing games development degree. He went to do that, unlike a lot of kids who went to do that because they... love playing computer games all the time. He loved playing board games. So his degree was based on board game development and strategy and things like that. And he, according to him, he's doing really well and he's on for a good degree.
Yeah.
But we are renowned for our positivity. but hopefully, he seems to be doing all right and he likes it up there and he's got a... He's in a student, a shared house with his girlfriend who's doing the same course at the moment. And they share the house with another guy. And it's, he's doing really well. I'm really proud of what he's done. You never know, what your children are going to do. And I was always very concerned that he was going to end up like me, which that some people say, well, that's not so bad. You've worked in America, you're a musician, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, mentally, he was always quite shy, quite relatively withdrawn. But when he left school, he got a job. He didn't go straight to university. He got a job for a couple of years. And he just really, really developed quickly.
Yeah.
You know, he's still got a bit of my oddness, but...
uniqueness.
Yeah, uniqueness, something like that. But yeah, it's really good to see him actually getting on with life and coping with it.
Yeah.
And some things are hard. They're always hard. He's rapidly learned the value of money while he's been at university.
They only will when they leave home.
Yeah. But he likes his independence now, and so that's good. He's not 100% sure what he's going to do when he leaves university, but I'd imagine there'll be a short stint at our house.
Yeah.
Or a long stint, because things are very hard at the moment, money-wise.
Yeah.
Finlay is, like I say, he's 3 years younger than Harry, so he's 20 at the moment. He left school. He struggled a bit at school. He did an extra year at school to do an extra course to try and give him another qualification at school. Qualification-wise, he did okay, actually, and he did games development as well, BTEC, and I think he got decent qualifications in that. Then he did the extra qualification, stayed at school. But since then, he hasn't got a job. He's been at home. He still lives at home at the moment. But he struggles a bit with... we're not 100% certain what he struggles with. But at the moment, he's been assessed for autistic spectrum disorder because he has varying problems which manifest themselves in strange ways, like there's a little bit of OCD kind of symptoms. Mm. He's got the tidiest bedroom of any teenager you've ever seen. Everything's lined up nicely. But he also can't be touched by people. He hates human contact of any form. And if he goes out, say, into Southend or something, he has to retrace his exact steps when he comes back. So he has a lot of problems with employability because of that.
Yeah.
And because we don't really understand what is going on, it is very difficult. And it's very difficult for me because I feel kind of helpless because I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And anything, all of the natural things I want to do... don't work. In fact, they make it worse.
Yeah.
So, and especially when all you really want to do is give him a hug.
Yeah.
And that's, you just can't do it.
It's the worst thing.
Because it'll sit him off. And when I say sit him off, it's a withdrawal. It's, he'd want to sort of go and just be by himself and hide or lie on the floor for a couple of hours or whatever. And it's very, very difficult being sort of helpless in that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the hardest thing I've had to deal with as a father. Just the helplessness of that situation. I mean, don't get me wrong, he's a bright kid and he's teaching himself computer animation and things like that at home.
Yeah.
He's very anxious of the real world, in a way that I think most people are. But he's got this extra thing on top. And it's not obvious, which is the difficult thing. Because to look at him, you would think he's a perfectly normal person. People say, well, why hasn't he got to? What's he doing? And, you know, everyone says, oh, what's he doing now? Is he still at home? Oh. And... you know, you don't really know what to say.
Yeah.
Because we don't really understand what's going on and he doesn't.
Mm.
But we're in the process of trying to sort it out at the moment. Good. So,
you mentioned that it makes you feel helpless.
Mm.
What would you like to be able to do then? Because helplessness comes from a place where you feel that there's nothing you can do. So what is it you feel that you should be doing, or you feel that you'd like to be able to do?
Again, it's very difficult not really knowing the cause of the problem. I mean, maybe it's a man thing. Maybe it's because I'm creative. I have also been an engineer and so a problem solver all my life. And I think a lot of men, they see a problem, they want to fix it, and they think, well, you need to do this, you need to do that.
Yeah.
And I can think of all the logical things that would help. But it's the equivalent of telling someone who suffers with depression to, you know, pull the socks up and smile or whatever. Yeah. It's pointless.
I ask it because I don't think it's got an answer. And and you saying that you feel helpless is exactly how you've just described it. I think it comes from a place where as men and or as a dad, you know, there's children get so much from both parents, but from dads, I think, you know, we know where we fall short in certain areas of love and attention or things that we're not particularly good at. But solving problems or coming up with an answer is kind of like our thing, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
Or a lot of us feel it is our thing.
It is, and I've been told off many times for doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the thing is that I don't think I understand that you would feel helpless, but I don't think you should need to feel helpless. I think what's happening is you just going through that process of rewiring your brain to see it from a different point of view. Because we spend a lot of time comparing, you know, and we look at other people and we look at what they're doing and we judge by other standards and other people judge us by theirs and all this sort of stuff. And it is a case of just thinking about it in a different way and changing the wiring in your brain because ultimately as a dad you're giving him everything that he needs at this point.
Yeah, but
and you're trying to understand.
You start to question yourself,
of course.
And you start to feel sort of guilty over, well, it, maybe if I had brought him up a slightly different way, maybe if I had, you know, done X, Y, Z with him when he was younger, maybe if I just pushed him a little, maybe if I hadn't pushed him, or maybe whatever. Yeah. But, you know, I'm also aware enough to, I think, understand that mental health issues like that, sometimes you can't do anything about them, and sometimes acceptance is what you need rather than trying to fix it, trying to accept it and say, okay, so this is the way it is. How are we going to work with it? Yeah. And how are we going to, you know, make a life out of it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know,
I always, and maybe it's just the way I think about things, I always think and I've spent a lot of time with younger adults with learning difficulties. And I found that we always focus on what somebody can't do. But actually, I found that with anyone with any kind of learning difficulty, we focus on the things that we feel are taken away. We don't actually focus on the things that they're given, because there is a gift there somewhere.
Yeah.
That their mind can do things that and their thought process and their creativity can do things that, if you like, other people can't. Yeah. And I always feel that, you know, in the human brain, what we feel sort of socially gets taken away.
Yeah.
We're gifted with something else.
We're always compared to what is deemed as the normal.
Exactly.
Although normal doesn't exist.
Exactly. It's a very patriarchal approach at life in the sense of it's very much a medical model, which is the medical model looks at the fact that things are either normal or abnormal. You know, there's no, and that's how medicine through the history has always worked. You know, this is the human body, this is the brain, this is what people do, this is what they shouldn't do, or this is when it's unwell or ill or things like that. And unfortunately, history has proven that medicine has got a lot of things wrong when they've deemed it normal or abnormal. Yeah. And certainly, you know, I think we're still very much in the early stages of understanding learning difficulties and understanding, and like I say, the gift that they give us, because some of the brightest minds in the world and people that have changed the world have had a learning difficulty. Yeah. And it isn't even a difficulty. It's just that they just have a different way of doing stuff. It's just different.
We have, through history and through the way that history has developed, we've built up a societal system that doesn't include, that is non-inclusive.
Yeah.
And what we're very slowly trying to do now is become more inclusive. But it's very hard when the whole world is set in that ways. And we're ahead of many countries.
Yeah.
And we're probably behind some as well.
Yeah.
And there's such a long way to go, but I don't know how you get to the point. But you can't get to the point quickly. You can't just expect everyone to say, oh, well, I'll just accept everyone. Then everyone's the same and everyone has the same opportunities, because the system doesn't work.
Yeah. I think the acceptance side of everybody's differences is tough. What I think we should be breaking down is trying to change people's understanding of what they think normal is. It's a different approach to it, because, I mean, in our lifetimes, if you think about how far we've come with education, now in our lifetimes, I'm sure, you know, we're a similar age, Chris. Like when we were at school, it was talk and chalk. You know, the teacher stood at the front, you sat in rows, and they just talked to you. Now, that doesn't suit. I mean, even I hated that. Now, I've gone on to get, you know, to university as an adult and got qualified. Well, I left school thinking I couldn't get it because that method of teaching didn't work for me. And really, when you think about the history of education, it's really only been in the last 20 years that we've actually started to realise that we need to vary the delivery methods, and that people's learning styles and the way that they understand, and education needs to be blended. And so we're really in our infancy in understanding a lot of those things, I think.
Yeah, and I think the unfortunate thing is that at the same time as the way we teach expanding to be more inclusive, the amount of help and finance the education system gets is being cut.
Yeah.
So it's fighting against itself again. We had a perfect opportunity to educate everyone. That is the problem with the world today.
Yeah.
But it is. It is simply education. If more people were educated and had the ability to think, not just intellectually but morally, if that was taught everywhere and money was thrown at it, then all that money would be saved in the future and the world would be a healthier, better place.
Yeah, yeah. There we go.
It's as simple as that.
We've solved the world.
There you go. Thank you very much.
No, it's a really interesting, and obviously it's a subject very close to your heart. I mentioned right at the beginning about your own. I said that you're a mental health advocate. You're very open and candid about your own issues. Mm. So we'll talk about that in a second. But just because we're talking about your son, you've mentioned little bits about it. Does it impact hugely? You've mentioned sort of the worry and you feel like the things. Does it have a stronger impact on your own mental health in any way?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the underlying things. I mean, my mental health is my son's problems are part of the baggage of my mental health.
Yeah.
And my mental health has many baggage compartments full of stuff. I mean, to talk a little bit about my mental health, I think about, I've always been shy.
Yeah.
That's what it was called at school. I've always been anxious. I was an anxious little boy. I was an anxious teenager. I was an anxious adult. I've never felt like I fitted in. I've always been socially awkward. I can't sort of start a conversation or something. if I'm in a situation where I'm supposed to be doing something and I know what I'm doing, I'm fine.
Mm.
So I'm normally quite good at what I choose to do because I focus on that and do it.
Yeah.
But if you put me in a room of strangers, I will be the one that after half an hour will be on one side of the room and everyone else will be on the other side of the room having a chat and I'll be sitting there awkwardly twiddling my thumbs.
Yeah.
And that's the way I've always been. It got to a point, I suppose, about 4 years ago now, I think it was 2018, where I kind of, I don't know, I just sort of had enough and decided to talk to someone about it. So yeah. I went to my GP
yeah.
and said, look, this is, I felt a bit daft because I felt, I was saying, look, this is what I'm like.
Yeah.
I've been like it forever. I don't want to be like it anymore.
Yeah.
And my GP was next to useless and gave me a phone number
yeah.
and said, ring this. And that was therapy for you.
Yep.
So I rang them. They had a great website and I rang them up. I did some CBT courses. Yep. I did some small group CBT courses. And then after that process, I went on to one-to-one therapy, which yeah. I had for about, I think it was about 18 weeks, which was quite a long time. You don't normally get that much time, yeah. but either I was just lucky or they felt I needed it. And at that time, I was very positive about my mental health. I found like I had suddenly owned it.
Yeah.
But an idea. I mean, the CBT kind of helps, but I think it sort of drifts away again if you're not on it all the time. Mm. And so, with lockdown and all that sort of stuff, I think it's all started to come back. But basically, my head is just full all the time.
Yeah.
It's constantly churning over thoughts, negative thoughts, too many negative thoughts. And I will have negative thoughts about everything, despite knowing the CBT. And yeah. I know what's going on and I know what I'm supposed to be doing. But you can't because I suffer with this problem.
Yeah.
I can't switch it off. No. Otherwise, I wouldn't suffer with it.
No. It's interesting, we were talking about America and we talked about the NHS earlier because physical health is covered very well in the NHS.
Mm, yeah.
Unfortunately, mental health isn't.
No.
We only really support people in crisis
yeah.
with mental health.
Yeah.
And whereas in America, I think the system there has got a much, much more healthier approach to regular counselling.
Yeah,
CBT, you know, it's accessible. It's, yeah. you know, yeah, you've got to pay for it or you have, there seems to be a much more of a positive way to actually say, oh, I'm going to my therapist each week
yeah.
or, and it seems we don't really have that here. And you know, your story there is an example where it sounds to me that you'd benefit from that on a regular basis.
Yeah. I think everyone should be yeah. prescribed therapy.
This is it here,
every
Chris.
Every week. Well, no, I mean, but things like that, this are kind yeah. of therapy for me. Any situation where I can talk, you know, openly and feel comfortable talking with someone is great therapy.
Yeah.
I was going to say for most people, that's normal life. But I'm well aware that a lot of people have problems that you don't see and you don't think.
Yeah, I don't,
you know.
I'm not sure it is. I think certainly, you know, I've worked in a female-dominated environment all my adult life. And my interest in doing things like this is because I do feel that things I hear sort of the women at work talking about over the water cooler, if you like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know,
yeah, yeah.
I don't hear men having those conversations with work colleagues.
No.
I don't hear them expressing some of the feelings that they're yeah. feeling just like over the desk when you're in an open office.
No. I mean, some of my biggest anxieties at the moment come from work.
Yeah.
because I'm a fish out of water.
Yeah.
I'm doing a manly job, a testosterone-driven job.
Yeah.
It's a very male-dominated thing. It's, most of the people will come in the morning, discuss the game from the night before, then go and play golf afterwards, then talk about the missus and all this stuff. I'm just not like that.
No.
And it gets me every day because even though I've been working for 35 years doing something in an office environment, it's alien to me. And I feel stupid because I know I'm punishing myself every day doing this just for the money.
Yeah.
But I'm, like I said before, I'm kind of trapped in it.
Yeah.
I need the money. But I don't know at what point that stops if I keep going until I literally break down and then have to do it.
Yeah.
Or do I do the sensible thing and, I don't know. Is the sensible thing quit my job and try and find another job? It's very tough.
I think it's something that a lot of men feel in regards to that exit point from what is possibly a large income in the family when you've got people to support, you've got children to support, that decision to say, can I just walk away from this, even though it's not making me feel great about myself and I'm not enjoying it. So I think a lot of men carry that, and I think it's a tough one. I think that the answer is a very individual thing, isn't it? I mean,
it is. Yeah.
I hold on to the fact that I think I've got a little bit of an exit plan, which will work for me financially. But I'm looking at that I can't put that into place until 7 years' time.
Yeah.
And then you're looking at 7 years, and I'm thinking, but I've got to get to that point. So one day I'm thinking, 7 years, and the other point thinking it's only 7 years, and it's crazy. But I think a lot of men go through that because you just have for that weight of responsibility with the income that you have.
Yeah, I mean, in our household, I mean, I'm by far the major breadwinner. Clarissa works part time at a local college as a teaching assistant. And she's also developing a photography career, which, I really love the fact that I can provide that sort of stability to allow her to do that thing she loves to do. And I don't hold any grudges against her or anything for doing that. But I also carry all the load of the household.
Yeah.
There's the house, the family, the boys, the money coming out and things like that. All these little pressures add up.
Do we do it to ourselves a little bit? Because I know if I said to my wife, I'm just going to quit tomorrow. I'm not enjoying this and it's making me feel unwell. She'd say, God, yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
We'll find a way. We'll work it out. I think that also weighs a little bit on me as well because I feel that personally I could just do that and I would be supported in that. But there's something that's stopping me from doing it as much as I know that there's a door there.
I think when I look at it logically, if you take away all emotion, then logically and financially, the best thing for our unit is to carry on because, we'd be much better off if I do it. The only person that's suffering is me.
Exactly.
And if I can put up with that suffering for a bit longer, hopefully it's not going to be too much longer. But it's another one of the reasons why especially in the last 10 years, I've crammed other stuff into my life, like the music and more recently, comedy.
Yeah.
And these are both therapy and my reason for being.
Yeah.
Otherwise, my life is pointless. If all I was doing was going to work in a job I don't like and coming home, there is no point.
No. I do feel that there's probably a lot of men that can relate to that. And that feeling having the opportunity to do other things. And you mentioned the music there, you're obviously a gifted musician. You're out there on Spotify, you're playing gigs, and you're talking about sort of feeling pressure and weight, things like that. You don't just go off and do it for yourself. You're very well known locally as somebody that is a huge supporter of original music and helping other people, and taking that pressure on of helping the weight of pressure of helping other people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, we've spoken before about your music, and I know it's something that you started off very young. But it sounds to me even more so in recent years. It sounds like it's becoming even a bigger and more central part of your life in making you feel the way that you feel.
It does. I mean, I started writing songs the same year I started work, and I started playing songs live 22 years after I started work.
Yeah.
And that was probably the best thing I've ever done, is getting up and playing in front of people, because I suddenly felt like I was in control and in a place that felt kind of natural.
Yeah.
And I could handle it, you know. Obviously, people had to listen to what I was playing, but hey, we got there. I forgot the point I was going to make. But so the music is, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword, is what I was going to say. Because I love music. I've always loved music. I've loved listening to it since I was, I don't know, 10 years old. I started buying records and things. And since I realised that you can make music and write music, I love it even more, because it's the way I express myself. I've got about a dozen songs which are pretty much a diary of my mental health over the past, you know, God knows how long, looking back on them. But at the same time, music is always seems to be such a self-deprecating thing, in that you never feel like you're good enough. You never feel like people really like it. You know, there's all these anxieties that just add up again. And especially as I'm getting older, I'm beginning to see question myself and saying, I've got, you know, on one shoulder, I've got a little musician saying, you know, you're good, people like you, you're writing your own songs, you're still valid, you can still do it, get out there and play. On the other shoulder, there's that man saying, your age, people are looking at you saying, really, you're still going? You know, there's all these young musicians out there and you're playing on the same bill as people who are a third of your age sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's really, are people just being nice to you and sort of saying and humouring you? And then, I mean, this is a glimpse into my brain, by the way. And this is what I put up with in every aspect of my life.
Yeah.
I will go through scenarios for everything. Even for coming here tonight, over the last 2 weeks, I've thought, oh, maybe I'm going to say this, maybe he'll say this, maybe he'll say, maybe this will happen, maybe that won't happen. But that's the way my brain works.
Yeah.
Just walking up the road, just doing anything, I will be mulling over every possibility of what might happen, of the negative things that might happen. I never go, oh, you're going to really smash it tonight. They're going to love you. They're gonna, you know. And that's what anxiety is.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been diagnosed with chronic anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
The depression I've kind of got a hold on now, because I can, there's ways to ward it off and sense it coming. But the anxiety is just always there, and it just gets you frustrated and as angry as I get.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really get angry. Don't do angry, but maybe I should.
Well, it's good that I said at the beginning, you're very candid about it, and it's really important. And it's good that you can talk about it and express it. And I think, like you say, just the opportunity to do that without therapists, this is what it's all about, really, isn't it? I think. And I think maybe if we all did this a little bit more as blokes, we would be able to sort of help each other's and shoulder each other's burden a little bit, because I do feel that there's a lot of things that you've said that resonate certainly with me, and I think people listening, there'll be people that will be feeling sort of a similar way. It doesn't necessarily lessen how you feel, but just sometimes knowing that other people might be feeling the same way.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely good to talk, and that's the one thing. When I sort of came out as a as someone who suffers with mental health. I was very open with what I was doing with the Therapy for You stuff and my therapy. I started writing a blog about my mental health journey, which is still out there if anyone wants to read it.
What's your blog called? Say it now.
Oh, here we go. What was it called? It was called it's called The Shadow Follows, right. And it's on WordPress, I think. And I haven't written in it for a couple of years now. And I think I don't really know why I suddenly stopped, but I want to write in it now, but I just can't get to it at the moment. And I got a lot of great feedback. Everyone was, right behind me. Yeah. Everyone was telling me how good it was I was talking to it and bringing it out there. But as soon as you stop talking about it, it all goes quiet again and you're back where you are.
Yeah.
So I think everyone has the willingness to want to accept and help, but people don't think about it all the time because it's not on their radar. Why would they,
I think it's not. I think it's finding moments, isn't it?
Yeah.
But just having enough moments because I think it's, mental health is health in any sense, and we all have it, and we all feel certain things in certain ways, to certain severities, and I think to a certain degree some people avoid conversations because they're mainly probably trying to just deal with their own stuff,
and
actually trying to ignore.
Yeah.
It is actually a strategy that works for a lot of people. So,
well, that kind of comes back to, saying that everyone should have access to therapy.
Exactly,
because you need that outlet.
You do need it, and that's why it's about. I think I put my experiences. It's about moments. It's having. Do you have enough moments? It's not something that we can necessarily feel that we can talk about all the time. In the same way with grief that we've brought up on the podcast before, you can't talk, but you just want to know that you've got. You can have a moment when you need a moment.
Yeah.
And I think that we're not even there. We're not even there yet, certainly as men, where we allow each other's in our friendship groups to give each other those moments often enough, because we distract ourselves with so many other things, like the football or like whatever, and other stuff that really is, we make it seem far more important than it is, because it's subtle ways of connecting and finding value and things like that without actually really talking about.
Some
of the real things. But you can't do it all the time. You can't talk about everything all the time. But you need those moments, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no one wants to hear me banging on about my mental health 24/7. But no, this is what I mean.
Yeah,
but
like
you say, for me, in the office, for example, there's no one there that I think I can talk to in this open kind of way.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's still a lot of men who don't talk about it. There's also a lot of men that still judge you on your manliness.
Yep.
And that's got to change.
Yes.
That's the thing that has to change. That stigma, if you want, it's just acceptance and accepting that people are different. And just because you don't like football doesn't mean you're So a different species.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's you're absolutely right. And we, like I say, I think I said earlier on, we sometimes men, we do it to ourselves, we do it to each other. We're our own worst enemies in not really kind of having each other's backs and just having that time. And the fact that you feel that there's no one at work that you can just have that. Yeah, it doesn't have to, if you were just having a rough day, you can go in and talk to them. And this is what I was saying with the women that I work with.
Yeah.
They very much, some of the conversations I've heard when someone's saying, they walk across the room and just say, I'm having a bad day at the moment. Oh, what's up? I wouldn't dream of that.
No, I just
rage when things go wrong.
Yeah, or you internalise it.
Yeah, or you internalise it. Yeah, absolutely. And you just sit hunched over your desk and just carry on with everything.
Get on with it.
Okay, well, we've covered a hell of a lot of stuff there, Chris.
I think we have.
We've put the world to rights. So one of the things I must remember to do this time, because I forgot to do it the last episode, it's just a little bit of a little fun thing, is the biopic of your life. So we're going to think, so if there was a film about your life, Chris, what would the film title be?
Yeah, the biopic of my life, I came up with One Step Away.
One Step Away.
Because I've always felt that I am just one step away from whatever,
yeah.
From being good at something, being happy, being this, being anything. And I've always been sounds awful. I've always been relatively good at everything.
Yeah.
But I've never been really good at anything. I'm always one step away from actually getting to the point where, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the story of my life. One step away. It's positive.
It's, yeah. But
with a hint of negativity.
Oh. Okay. And who would play you in this film? I know who I think it should be.
See, I've thought about this long and hard, and the person I've come up with, I didn't think I would come up with, but it's actually Tom Hanks.
Oh, right, okay. That's a good one.
Purely because of the way he acts, and I think he'd be able to get the emotive side of me. I think he'd be able to capture a bit of what's going on in my head.
Yeah.
So I didn't pick an actor for, obviously, my good looks or anything.
Well, obviously.
So yeah, that's who I came up with.
See, I would have gone. I would have gone for a Liam Neeson.
So Liam Neeson was on the list.
Oh, was it on the list? Oh,
it
is.
On the list.
I think a film called One Step Away with Liam Neeson. It's kind of like a Taken, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good action movie.
Yeah.
And what about a theme song?
Well, a theme song. I mean, I went with an existing song, and it may be obvious, but it's Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Yeah.
Because despite my mental health problems and any other problems I have, I'm a very positive person. And I think it's because of that that I deal with a lot of the pressures that I have, because I can always see, I'm very good at seeing both sides to a story, but I'm also very good at thinking there's going to be a positive outcome.
Yeah.
Or I've always got hope.
Yeah.
And I think hope is what's kept me alive.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. So, yeah, it's that song.
Excellent.
And
yeah.
It's a nice, fun song.
You are a very positive person, Chris, and all the time that I've known you, and as I said earlier on, you know, the effort and the time that you put into other people's happiness as well is really important, and something that I hope you value, because the people that you do it for certainly do.
Yeah, I don't know. I just do what I do. I don't know.
There you go. That's part two of the.
Yeah, I just do what I do.
That's the sequel.
Yeah.
So we're coming towards the end, Chris. What's next for you then? I mean, not work-wise, music-wise, what's coming up?
Music-wise, well, gigs are just starting to rear their ugly heads again, which is good. So I'm organising a few gigs. I'm doing a full Chris Robson gig at Temple Cafe in May the... I should know this date, shouldn't I? I want to say something like the 14th, around then. Anyway, you see it on my socials.
You
can find it. And that'll be a good one, because I'm going to play all my songs and explain the songs and, you know, get into it and maybe talk a little bit about mental health as well.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've got a few other gigs coming up. We've got the Lee Folk Festival is coming along quickly. I've got the Pin Drop Sessions, which I run, which we're still building that up nicely.
Yeah. And so, what about new music? Are you writing? You've got anything coming out? Any albums?
I have got a song that I've recorded, which is ready to go out. It's not a new song. It's an old song, but it's one I haven't recorded properly before. But I have been writing recently. I've just finished, I've done two or three songs, one which I'm quite proud of, two which are sort of songs that may need a bit of work. yeah, I've just finished a song called The Accountant.
Right, okay.
Which is a bit of a weird song. It's like a song about, it could be me, a song about a man who's fed up with his work in life, but he actually breaks things happen.
Ah.
So, yeah, and so I'll be out playing that live hopefully soon. And, I want to do another EP or maybe an album.
Excellent.
This year.
So on your socials, so on the Facebook, it's all Chris Robson Music.
Yep, it's Chris Robson Music. Instagram's at Chris Robson Music.
And we always do this on Spotify, so because there's a few Chris Robsons out on Spotify, so we always say, give us a... So we'll do Chris Robson and the song title to find. What's the...
The one I always like to say is Chris Robson, Not Worth It. And so if you look up Not Worth It and my name, you'll find all my stuff.
But it is very much worth it, Chris.
Yes, of course it is.
And it has been very worth it speaking to you for this episode. And I just want to say thank you very much for coming on and being my guest and talking very candidly about everything.
Well, thanks for having me again in the shub.
Yes, yes.
Hopefully this won't be the last shub visit. And, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And, you know, if anything I have said rings true with anyone else, then, you know, that's great. And
excellent.
Hopefully it will.
Thank you so much, Chris. Yes, that's it. So we're done. So please follow us on Instagram or our Facebook page and tune in for the next episode. We'll be chatting a little bit more. We'll have another guest and we'll see what comes up. So until next time, please take care and look after each other.